So Parshas Vayeshev and Hanukkah, you know that it's not a coincidence that themes that you find in the Parsha seem to fit in very well with the cycle of the Jewish year and the Inyane Dioma, the issues of the moment, and the fact that Vayeshev and Hanukkah go together and Miketz and Hanukkah go together is not by accident. It's because Ezra, in the time of the return to Eretz Yisrael in the beginning of the second Beis Hamikdash era, specifically set it up that we should read one, or sometimes in a leap year, two parshios a week. And he set it up that we begin, you know, Shabbos Bereishis, and we end by Shmini Atzeres. He could have set it up anyway. There was no, you know, not necessarily an automatic connection between Shmini Atzeres and Simchas Torah, which we celebrate on the same day. But Ezra set it up this way because it is built into the system that these parshios, when read in this order, always work out with the themes at hand in any case. So what we're going to see today, what we're going to start with is we're going to start with the first Rashi and a Gemara on Hanukkah. Our subject today is understanding the victory of the Jews against the Greeks from a new angle. We're working with pretty much Rav Huttner's ideas. This is, Rav Huttner is, of course, wrote the, his daughter, Rebbetzin David, wrote the Pachad Yitzchak for him. And this section on Hanukkah is translated by Rav Pinchas Stolper, who does a lot of work with Rav Huttner's writings. It's called Hanukkah in a New Light, and the themes we're going to be working with today come from, these are Rav Huttner ideas pretty much as expressed in this book. And what we're working with really are the ideas of the Geula. What type of Geula was this? The Geula of the Jews against the Greeks? What type of redemption? And we're going to work with two terms. We always work with little words, understanding words, like we worked with Kol recently, right? So we're going to work with today the terms Hod Vahadar, which always seem to go together. Hod Vahadar. Hod Vahadar Lavashta. Hadar Kavod Hodecha, right? A lot of examples of Hod and Hadar. And we know they both mean beauty in some form or the other. But our objective today is to understand what type of beauty Hod and Hadar are expressing. Okay, what type of beauty that is. And how that relates to Hanukkah. So we know that Hod comes up in Hanukkah because they established, as we say in Al Hanisim, these days of Hanukkah, Lahodot Ulahalil. Right, and we already began to speak about Shtika Kahoda'a vis-a-vis HaKadosh Baruch Hu last week, right? So these are our themes. What type of redemption was it? What is Hod and what is Hadar? And what is the first Rashi in Vayeshev trying to tell us here? It's kind of, everything kind of pivots on that. So let's look at the first Rashi in Vayeshev. Vayeshev Yaakov Eretz Mugurei Aviv, Yaakov settles down. Ela told us, Yaakov, these are the offspring of Yaakov. These are the chronicles of Yaakov's life. Told us generally means the children, right? And then you don't get a list of the children. You only get one child mentioned. Ela told us, Yaakov, Yosef, stop. Okay? So Rashi goes into talking about how Yosef is the essential child. And halfway towards the end of the Rashi, towards the end, he brings a Dover Acher, something else he wants to say to help explain this connection between Yaakov and Yosef, why the Torah basically seems to say that the only real offspring of Yaakov in some way was Yosef. Ela told us Yaakov, Yosef. The Torah is telling us Yosef is the Iker, somehow the Ikar, like Rachel was the Ikar. There's something about Yosef which is the official, the fundamental offspring of Yaakov. So here he says, Dover Acher, another way to explain this is, Hapishtani Hazeh, there was somebody who, a merchant, who sold Pishtan. Flax, right? Was that right? Flax. And this Pishtani, Nichnasu Gemalov to Unim Pishtan, his camels, laden down with Pishtan, entered into a blacksmith shop, the Hapachmi Tamai, and the blacksmith was wondering, how am I going to get all this Pishtan in? What am I going to do with these mounds and mounds of Pishtan, of flax? Hayah Pikech Echad, so one smart person said to him, don't worry, one little clop from your hammer will create a spark, which will go and it will consume all of this flax. So that's how you could get rid of all of this flax that's flooding your store. Okay? So what is that? What is Rashi trying to say? So he goes on to explain that Kach Yaakov, Yaakov saw all the Alufim, all these princes of Esav that were just mentioned in the last 22 psukim of the previous parsha, and he thought to himself, you know, Tama, he thought, he wondered, Va'amar, Miyachal Lichvosh Es Kulam, who can conquer all of them? How are you going to overcome Esav? Overcome all of these princes of Esav, this huge nation, this powerful nation. So what is written directly afterwards? Ela told us Yaakov, Yosef. Don't worry, Yaakov. The power is in the offspring, Yosef, to overcome and defeat ultimately Esav, which is just previously mentioned. Then he goes on Exiv, and that's what we're saying. Haya Beis Yaakov Esh. Beis Yaakov is a fire. Beis Yosef Lahava, and Beis Yosef is a flame or a spark. Obeis Esav, and Esav is kash, is straw. So put it all together. Yaakov is fire, Esav is straw, and Yosef is the spark. If there's a fire burning here in a huge mound of straw, or in the case the Rashi brings, pishtan, and what are you going to take loads and loads of this straw or this flax and put it into the fire? No, you don't even need to do that. How are you going to get the flax or the straw into the fire of Esav? How are you going to get Esav consumed by Yaakov? All you have to do is let that fire shoot off a spark. Bang, you know, the blacksmith smashes his hammer down and a spark flies off, or you have a red hot iron, right? You create a spark and that's it. It starts burning in the straw and the straw is consumed. So Yosef is that spark that flies off from the fire. In other words, an extension of the fire that can consume the straw, which is Esav. So first of all, stop here for a second, and let's go back to a basic idea of what we mean when we're talking about Esav as the extension of Yaakov with the power to consume Esav. Let's decide what we mean here. Rav Huttner talks about an idea which we've mentioned numerous times. He says that the koach to create, to establish, and to ensure the continual existence of Klal Yisrael came in stages. We see these stages expressed through our ancestors, through the Avos. Avram was the first one to establish the possibility that a person can become by intellectually understanding something and then buying into it and committing to it, a person can become a Jew. However, you can have a lot of like-minded people, a community of like-minded people that doesn't create a nation. It creates a community of people that agree with each other. But you keep having to fill, if that's the basis of your nation, you keep having to find more, you know, converts to come in. How do you perpetuate it? Automatically. So Yitzchak establishes for us the possibility that you can actually pass on your faith to the next generation automatically. Yitzchak is Kadosh Mibet, and he's already, you know, considered a Jew from the time he's born. So Yitzchak establishes the possibility that the Jewish faith can be transferred via birth. But that doesn't guarantee a Jewish nation. Because, you see, by Yitzchak's own children, Esav, right? And certainly by Avraham, but even by Yitzchak, you can conceive and give birth to a person who is born into the faith. At the same time, they can abandon the faith. They can just abdicate, buy out of it. And then you don't have a religion anyway. You don't have a faith anyway. You can be born into it, but that doesn't guarantee the perpetuation of the religion. Because people can still be lost to the religion through their own choice. So with Yaakov, we establish the following principle. Chazal tell us, with Yaakov, it is established the following. You can not only come to the belief in a religion and a concept, right? Become a Jew in your head. That's a ger, really. Then you can pass it on. Then we are guaranteed through Yaakov that if you pass it on to your children and those children sin, even in terrible ways, they're still considered Jews. Yisrael afilu shechata Yisraelu. A Jew, even if they sin, is considered a Jew. There's always a possibility for tshuva. Always a possibility for tshuva. That's established by Yaakov, and you see that through the children of Yaakov. They sinned a couple of ways. They sinned Shimon and Levi in Shechem. Yaakov was against them. The brothers with Yosef, and nevertheless, they're Klal Yisrael. They can do tshuva, and they're Klal Yisrael. However, that doesn't guarantee that the nation will continue to survive forever, because there's still the possibility that they will be lost to assimilation, complete and total assimilation, which is more than just sinning and repenting. Total assimilation. The koach to ensure that Klal Yisrael, the power to ensure that Klal Yisrael will be able to resist assimilation, which we call Shmad, which is Hanukkah, that's what they wanted to do, as you all know, is expressed through Yosef's achievement of being in Mitzrayim, not assimilating, not falling. It's in that final, decisive moment with Ashes Potiphar to intermarriage, total assimilation. He resisted. That guarantees forever that Klal Yisrael, at least the core of Klal Yisrael, will have the power to resist total assimilation, shmad, intermarriage. We will stay in existence as a Jewish people. That's the koach of Yosef. Clearly you see that Ela told us Yaakov, Yosef, if not for Yosef, then the kochos of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov could end. They could just dissipate through assimilation. Yosef guarantees. He's the extension of the koach of Yaakov. He's the extension of the koach of, even though a Jew sins, they're a Jew, and they will never fully assimilate. They will never completely, be that weak that when the forces of forced conversions and Gezeiras HaShmad and forced assimilation, in our day, the most recent communism, but it goes back, the Inquisition, the Church, the first one being Hanukkah, the first ever was Hanukkah, that the Jewish people will have the ability to resist this because of Yosef. That's the extension of Yaakov. That's the spark off the fire. Okay, so now Rashi says, Ela told us Yaakov, Yosef. The Iker Tolda, the essential offspring, the guarantee for Yaakov's koach is Yosef. And he says, Yaakov is the fire. Esav, which is the forces against us that want us to assimilate, that is the straw. And it's the spark of Yosef that can consume it, which means to say, our perseverance as Jews, which we spoke about last week, ultimately will overcome, outlive, and consume all the enemies that try to destroy us. Then he goes and brings a mashal of this merchant of Pishtan, whose flax ends up in a blacksmith shop, and what am I going to do? And just bang your hammer or your red hot rod that you're using there, and the spark will burn up the Pishtan. Where's Rashi inventing this mashal from? So, where Rashi's not inventing it. Now, in the Sechah Shabbos, the second parak, Daf Chaf Aleph, the second Amud Beis, in the part of the Gemara that tells you why we celebrate Hanukkah, my Hanukkah, you get the Gemara, the Hanukkah's in the Gemara, it's not in the Mishnah. My Hanukkah. What is Hanukkah? And it goes into an explanation, two reasons. First reason, Chanukah Samizbeah, Chinuch, dedication. Establishing once again the avoda in the base of Mikdash. The other answer being Chanuk Chafei, that they rested on Chafei. Two totally different answers. One is the military victory, and one is the spiritual victory. The first one is the spiritual victory. Chanukah Samizbeah. Right? And then he goes on to bring here the Gemara derives a law from a Mishnah that discusses torts, right? Damages. So here's what the Gemara brings down. Now watch this. We learn from here, there's a Mishnah. If a spark flies out from under a blacksmith's hammer and damages another person's property, it's chayiv. That's a rule. Okay, it's a rule that the Gemara starts with. Now, if a camel is laden with flax, okay, and it was passing through a public domain, and its flax protruded into a shop, and was ignited by the shopkeeper's light, and the burning flax then set a mansion ablaze, the camel's owner is liable for all the damage to the building. If, however, the shopkeeper placed his light outside the shop in the public domain, then the shopkeeper is liable. However, Rabbi Yehuda says, if it was a Hanukkah light, the shopkeeper is not liable. So, we have a Gemara that talks about a Pishtani who has a camel full of flax, who happened to set something ablaze. But if the blaze started because of Hanukkah menorah, then the one who lit the Hanukkah menorah is putter, because that's okay. The Hanukkah menorah can burn up someone else's flax, and it's putter, it's okay. Now, Rashi is clearly taking this mashal and applying it to Yosef, that Yosef is the one that's going to burn up the flax, which is Esav, just like this shopkeeper who lit his Hanukkah menorah is not liable for burning up this other random person's whole entire, their entire, let's say, their whole life's savings in Pishtan. Okay? So Rashi is clearly associating Yosef, the spark, with the Hanukkah menorah. That's obvious, right? So now we look for the connection between Yosef, the spark of Yosef, the force not to assimilate, is also a koach in Hanukkah. Now, but we're talking about fires. We always associate Hanukkah with aur, with light, but we're actually focusing on fire. Yosef's a fire. The Hanukkah menorah has a fire. So let's start talking about fires and the koach of the fire of Hanukkah menorah, which resembles the koach of Yosef. Now, the first similarity is obvious. Yosef is anti-shmad. Hanukkah is the resistance against shmad. Both of these things, shmad being forced assimilation, right? And sometimes the ability to assimilate voluntarily, the strength to stand firm in that against that temptation. That's clearly Hanukkah and Yosef, right? We see that? Shmad, the power to resist shmad, assimilation, that's Hanukkah, the desire to resist forced assimilation. Okay? By the way, the Hashmonaim were not just fighting the Greeks, unfortunately. They were fighting a lot of Jews, Hellenized Jews that were assimilating willingly. So it's not just forced assimilation, it's the gravitational pull to natural assimilation that we're fighting, that we're resisting the temptation to. So that combination is clear, that comparison rather is clear, Yosef and Hanukkah, the fire and the fire. So the fire of Hanukkah is going to represent to us, and the fire in the menorah is going to represent to us the koach in a Jew, not to assimilate. Okay? But when we talk about fire, fire gives off aur, gives off light. It's very interesting that the beginning of Torah Shebaal Peh, we always talk about this, we talked about this, mentioned this last week, is associated with Hanukkah, because although we make a bracha by Purim, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam Asher Kedeshanu B'mitzvos V'tzivanu L'kroa Megillah, right? But the Chachamim made the Megillah, right? Nevertheless, when they wrote the Megillah, it really was very much like a Doraisa that Hashem commanded us, because it was in fulfillment of the mitzvah of remembering to forget Amalek, right? To wipe out Amalek. Remembering to erase the memory of Amalek. That's the Megillah. The erasure of Amalek's memory. So it really was in fulfillment of a mitzvah doraisa, correct? However, Hanukkah, you get for the first time a mitzvah drabbanon that doesn't really have a precedent, other than we have to listen to the rabbis. In the first time you get a mitzvah drabbanon that becomes incumbent upon everyone, and we make a bracha, Baruch Atah Hashem, Elokeinu Melech Olam Asher Kedeshanu B'mitzvos Avetzivanu Lahadlik Ner Hanukkah, and it's a drabbanon. So the mitzvos drabbanon, which by the way there are seven: Netilas Yadayim, Brachas, Hallel on Rosh Chodesh and on Hanukkah, Megillah, and a couple others. Brachas Amazon. No, but they added the bracha. They added the bracha and benching. That's not necessarily... Okay, but in any case, it's in my other notes, which I didn't bring. There's one missing, huh? Is that last year's notes? Good. Oh, Erev Tashilin, that's right. Hanukkah, Shabbos, Erev Tashilin, that's right. Okay. In any case, it's the first time there's a mitzvah drabbanon, okay, that we establish as doraisa, we take as full authority. Now, we consider it like that, right? So it's the beginning of the authority of the Chachamim. Now, we spoke about this. Chachamim replacing prophets, right? And it's the beginning of the explosion of Torah Shebaal Peh. Since they sealed the Tanakh with the last, Sfarim of Megillas Esther and the last Sfarim of the Nevi'im and the Ksuvim, after that, the gazillion Sfarim, that have been written since that time, starting with the Mishnah and everything till this very day, all comes from within us. It's Torah that is sourced within us. It emerges from within us. As we spoke about, we were Hashem taught us, and now it's integrated, and we're in a sense giving it back. So what you have here is that Hanukkah begins Torah Shebaal Peh, the real era of Torah Shebaal Peh. The menorah has a fire, and the fire gives off a light. Okay? So the era of Torah Shebal Peh does begin with a fire, with the fire of Hanukkah. Well, the era of Torah Shebichsav also began with a fire. Also in a very, you know, in a structure that looked like it had a few branches, but, you know, not much of a big tree, but a couple of sparse branches. What was that? The sneh. Torah Shebichsav comes to the world in a fire of the sneh. Torah Shebal Peh comes to the world in the fire of the branched menorah. Okay? What we're saying is that Torah, there's a continuum. There's a continuum of the fire of Torah that originates in Torah Shebichsav and finds new expression in Torah Shebal Peh through the menorah. Fire is associated with light. Now, you've heard us say this before. The day that Hashem said, Vayihi Ar, that great light of the Shekhinah, was the 25th of Elul. 3 months later, there's also Ar in the world. It's 3 months later, the 25th of Kislev, Hanukkah. Okay? There's something mysterious about Ar being hidden for 3 months and then emerging. You see it again with Moshe. Moshe's born on Zion Adar. There's Ar in the house. He's hidden for 3 months. In Zion Sivan, you know, there's a machlokas on the day of Matan Torah, which we've spoken about here. We celebrated on Vav. But 3 months later, that Ar comes to the world in the form of the Torah. Oraisa, Ar. By the way, when Tamar, the whole incident with Yehuda and Tamar, becomes pregnant with Mashiach's ancestors. She's pregnant for 3 months, after which she can no longer hide it, and it becomes obvious, and that whole incident happens, which leads to Yehuda saying, which we're going to get to, Tzad Kami Meni. So you have the Or of Torah, and the Or of Mashiach, and the Or of the Shekhinah, created, hidden, and emerging. It's just an interesting pattern. But in any case, the Or, the light, as expressed through the fire of the Sneh, we're putting together Or and fire, starts with Yehi Or, that's the Or HaShekhinah, the Or that was shining off Moshe's face, the Or of the future, that where we'll see everything clearly, expressed originally through the Sneh, then through Matan Torah with the big fire on the mountain, and then it transitions and it becomes the Or of the menorah. Now, we said last week that the first 1,000 years was Hashem doing miracles and wonders. We called that Leia. The Gra calls that Leia. And it's an explosion of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's power being revealed in the world. And that's supposed to compel people to submit to the will of Hashem, right? And to at least obey the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, correct? But we said that era didn't last forever, it was 1,000 years, and it didn't really work perfectly, because by the end of those 1,000 years, the world was not completely in the service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu yet. Torah transitioned into a new form, and it said a form that comes from us, a form that originates with people, Torah Shebal Peh, our survival through the Gullus. Remember these ideas? That's Kimu V'Kiblu, what we agreed to on Purim, was that forever after, from this point on, we would allow Torah to be revealed through us, through our survival, physically and spiritually. We'd fight for it, we'd die for it, we'd sacrifice for it, and through our persistence, we would eventually reveal to the world the original truth that Hashem tried to reveal through the great miracles, Ani Hashem, B'ni B'chori Yisrael, the Torah is eternal, you cannot separate the Jews from the Torah. Those ideas that Hashem conveyed for 1,000 years, we will now take in our hands, convey to the world through our survival, through our spiritual survival, through our mysterious nefesh, as expressed through Hanukkah. So Torah transforms into a different kind of light. However, now there's a competition to that transformation, and that comes in the form of the Greeks. And here we get to two basic ideas, which we're going to describe as internal and external knowledge. You see, as Torah transitioned from coming from Hashem to coming from us, it really transitioned from being outside of us, external, to becoming from within side of us, internal. Very important transition. Because any knowledge that you acquire that comes from outside yourself, even if it's through a huge miracle or it's through prophecy, through Moshe speaking on behalf of God to the Jewish people, any knowledge that you acquire from the outside has a deficit. The flaw is that the knowledge and the knower are not one and the same. There's information, there's me, I hear it, I see it's true, I accept it, but it didn't come from me, and I all can disconnect from it. I can rationalize it away, I can turn my back on it. It's not within me. External knowledge has a flaw. The 1,000 years of Nisim and Nevuah had within it the flaw that it came from a Kadosh Baruch Hu. That was, in a certain way, a shortcoming. It didn't come from within the knowledge of the people and themselves. So it was external. It had to become internalized. It had to go inside a person. Now, how do you get information that's outside of you inside of you? So there is actually a method that the Gemara says in Avodah Zarah. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah tells you that there's only one real way to connect to Torah knowledge, truth, which originally is outside of you, and then, you know, to try to make it become part of you. By the way, David HaMelech alludes to it in the first perek of Tehillim. It says, Ki betoras Hashem cheftso, God's Torah is his chefetz, ubetoraso, and in his own Torah, yege yomam v'layla, he delves and dwells in it. How did it go from being God's Torah to his own Torah? How did that just happen? There's a word there, cheftso, chafetz. So the Gemara in Avodah Zarah says the following. The Gemara says, The Gemara says, Ein Adam Lomei Torah, Ella Mimakom Shalibo Chafetz. And it says it a number of times in the Gemara. In Meseches Avodah Zarah, Daf 19, Yutes Amud Aleph says, Ein Adam Lomei Torah. A person will only learn Torah, which means truly learn it and internalize it. Mimakom Shalibo Chafetz. From the place his heart desires, which means there's a rule. In every halacha, there's specific rules. When Shabbos starts and when Shabbos ends. Exact times. Okay? Every halacha has gedorim, has boundaries. Did you notice that when it comes to learning Torah, there are no rules. You have to learn one page of Chumash, two Mishnayos, a half a blot of Gemara, three psukim of Navi. There's no rules. There are no rules about what you have to learn. You should learn all the time, but there's no specific rules about what you should learn. A person should learn whatever their heart desires. You like Chumash? Learn Chumash. What type of Chumash? You like learning with the Mefarshim that deal with Diktuk all day? Learn Diktuk. You like learning halachic derivations from the Pasuk? Learn halachic Mefarshim. You like philosophical Mefarshim? Learn philosophy. You like Gematrias? Learn the Baal HaTurim. You like a rational, historical type of approach? Learn the Abarbanel. Whatever you want, learn the Mefarsh you like. Whatever your heart desires. You don't like learning Chumash so much, you prefer Gemara, learn Gemara. You don't like Chumash or Gemara and you prefer Halacha, so learn Halacha. It's a free-for-all. Seriously, you could learn. Now, we're encouraged to learn certain things, but there's no Halacha. A person, the Gemara states, Ein Adam Lo Meid, know this, a person will not learn, will not really fully grasp and integrate and remember and retain any knowledge that they don't desire to learn. Which means, Rav Huttner says, you only retain something you get pleasure out of. You have to find the pleasure in the style of Torah that you like to learn. If you get pleasure from it, it becomes yours. That's how you get Torah from outside, das, knowledge that comes from the outside, to becoming part of you, because you love it, because you get pleasure from it, because you desire it, because it captivates you, because you think about it, because you understand it, because it hits home, because it relates, because you get it, something about you gets this type of learning, it makes sense, it's true, you get a pleasure from it, and then it's yours. It goes through the medium of pleasure, of intellectual pleasure. Right? So, as the Gemara says, you will not learn if you do not learn something you love. So learn what you love. So that's how Torah transitions from external to internal. The most important tefillah that is associated with Hanukkah is one of the brachas in the Berachas HaTorah. Which one is it? One of the requests, really, in the Berachas HaTorah? Exactly. V'harev na, and Hashem, please make it sweet. Please make the Torah learning sweet. Harev na. make it pleasurable. We have a bakasha, a request that we say every day that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give us the pleasure of the Torah learning. Because that's the only way that Torah will become ours. So what happens is that in this transition that we talked about last week from Nisim and Nevuah to Klal Yisrael having Torah emerge from within ourselves, there had to be the element of pleasure, of gratification, of Sipuk HaNefesh that came with that transition, that made it individual in the person. Now that was the Greek, that was really, if you want to get to the core of it, the confrontation with the Greeks. The Greeks are also great intellectuals. Very much so. And the Greeks believed in knowledge, which we did too. So why were we in such opposition to them? We were similar. Finally, a culture on earth that believed in knowledge, that believed in learning. And not just in the excesses of physical, you know, indulgence. So the confrontation we had with the Greeks, and why Chazal tell us that they made our eyes dark, is because they had no problem with intellectual learning and knowledge and truth. It was the internalization of it that made us act differently. That made us act differently. That made us conquer our impulses and put our physicality second and put the concept of survival of the fittest as opposed to the strong protecting the weak, right? They had Rabim Biad Ma'atim, right, strong in the hands of the weak. What is that all about? You can have intellectual ideas. You could be the most, look at Germany, advanced society on earth, developed with poets and writers and philosophers and everything. But to integrate that and want to act differently, specifically in this, you can see this in Germany too, by the way, which is that their philosophy was will to power. In other words, if you have the strength, you can use it to dominate, where we say, if you have the strength, you restrain yourself and protect the weak and the poor and the helpless. You don't take advantage of it. You know, there is no such thing as a dictatorship. So, submission of the self, submission of our own power for a greater good. That was anathema to the Greek culture. You know how the Greek culture was. There was later in Rome, the patricians, you know, the higher class, and then everybody else who was nothing. And so this concept of not just information, but integration, choice, and submission, a society of equality. You know, you're in the Nechama Leibowitz, brings down a letter that a Roman general, much later after the Churban, wrote back to Rome and says, I can't deal with these Jewish people. Their whole society makes no sense. They free their slaves. They free their slaves. How is their economy supposed to grow? I mean, what is wrong with them? You know, we don't think alike at all. No comprehension or appreciation for what we did. Because it doesn't lead to the individualized power. So what we have is a confrontation, not with the pursuit of knowledge, but the integration of knowledge. And what that knowledge does to a person is it makes them machnia, submit to Hashem's truth, Hashem's will versus our will. Submit our power, restrain our own power for the good of the other person. Not total domination, no dictatorship, no sense of authoritative, you know, total authoritative type of empire building. It's not like that. It's a whole different ballgame. Here we get to understanding the concept of Hod and Hadar. Our beauty is called Hod and Hadar. The beauty of our society and our Torah is Hod and Hadar. Not something they could understand. A different type of beauty. Their beauty was in the dominance of the individual physical beauty and the beauty of the state and the state institutions at the, you know, mercy of everybody else. And by the way, by the Greeks, if your body wasn't perfect, you were dead, right? If a child was born deformed or imperfect, or there were too many females, certainly in Rome later on, they used to send their, you know, the girls or the deformed or the sick out, off, you know, to die in the ocean, on a raft somewhere. Right? So, and we had a whole different concept. So what we're talking about here is the transition of Torah from coming from the outside to becoming internalized, something happens. When we internalize Torah, we begin to submit to Hashem's will in a thousand ways, and our whole society looks different. Our whole culture is set up on different rules. And it's not something they appreciate at all. Hitler himself said, the Jews are the conscience of mankind, and that's why they hated us. We have a conscience. And conscience means restraint. So now we get into the idea of the beauty of Hod and the beauty of Hadar. Now, Hod and Hadar go together. The relationship between Hod and Hadar is that when you can appreciate the beauty of Hod, which is only retroactively, then it's called Hadar. In other words, Hod becomes Hadar. What is Hod? Hod comes from the word Hoda'ah, to be Modeh. Modeh manachnu lach. What does that mean? We acknowledge our debt to you. We acknowledge our responsibility to you. We acknowledge that we have to submit to you. To acquiesce. That's Hoda'ah, acquiescence. Right? So, when the Jewish people submit to the will of Hashem, that's a form of Hod. There's another form of Hod. It's compared to, Ravuna compares it to a reed. When there's a storm, raging, and you see the reeds are completely submerged under the floods of the waves, you don't see them anymore. You think, oh, they're such weak plants. As soon as the first wave comes, there they go down. It's not till after the storm is over, and after the sea stops churning, that you see, guess what? They're still standing. That wasn't weakness. That wasn't weakness. That was submission for the moment, which is really strength and survival. Klal Yisrael's beauty comes from retroactively, which is our vantage point, the vantage point now of the end of history, looking back and saying, yes, the Jews were expelled and they left, they went from place to place. What were they supposed to do? They submitted to the greater force at the time. They were subject to the Inquisition, they were burned, they submitted. They were subject to pogroms, to massacres, to forced conversions, right? They submitted to it all. But guess what? They're still standing. They're still here. By the way, that's, my brother heard a Swedish guide tell his group by the Kotel after somebody asked, why do they sway like this when they pray? And he compared it to the reeds. So he did the same exact mashal. So wait a second. Looking back, you begin to see Hadar, the beauty of the Jews, is in their constant submission and yet survival despite that submission. So that submission is not weakness. That submission of the Jews is an inevitability, but there's an inner strength that makes us rise back up, and here we are standing. Hod, from Hoda'ah, becomes Hadar. Hadar Kavod Malchuscha, that the Hadar brings, that Hadar shows us the Kavod of the Malchus of Hashem. Now let's look at it and nationally, individually, and from Hashem's perspective. Hashem also, we said, Shtika Kahoda'ah. Hashem is quiet because he acquiesces. Another twist on how we explained it last week. As a nation, how likely is it that our ideas of morals and ethics and truth, right? In another class recently, we read Hilchos Malachim of the Rambam. 3,000 years ago, when the Torah was given, 3,300 years ago, there were laws. And you know what those laws say? That a king can be given Malkus by Beis Din. You know what that means, the rule of law? Everyone equal unto the law, under the law? The world didn't function like that 3,300 years ago. Not till America did the world function like that, till democracy. America wasn't the first democracy, but it was the beginning. The concept of rule, everyone equal under the law, it's unheard of, right? The beauty of our ideas, the beauty of the biblical morality that is the foundation of this country, that every pathetic, nebuch, miserable refugee from everywhere else ends up here, as we've spoken about, because it's built on ideas of freedom and decency, and a person can live, and a person can practice their religion, and a person can express themselves here. The beauty of our ideas built entirely off biblical values. How likely is that beauty to exist under these conditions? It comes from a nation, not the Greeks, who had an empire, and they had national institutions from which they could promulgate their ideas, and they could write, and they could speak, and they had orators. Right? That's not where these ideas came from. These ideas came from a people, no land, no money, no property, no possessions, no influence. Annihilated every 30 seconds. How likely is it that the beauty of those ideas would survive would constantly simmer in the minds of men, thoughtful men, and women, and emerge at the end of history, thousands of years later, to be the root, the basis of whatever's decent and good in this world. The Hadar, the beauty of the Jewish ideas, of the Jewish nation, comes from the Hod, the constant submission. The proof is, the strength of our ideas is established by the fact that they existed, the pen is mightier than the sword, that our ideas persisted despite the fact that they had no mouthpiece, a few books that they burned every 5 minutes. That's where these ideas lived, in the minds of people, in our conversation, in our books that they kept on burning. And yet these ideas persisted. That's the Hod, that we keep submitting, but there we are standing, and there we are. That's the Hod and the Hadar of the Jewish nation. You see it retroactively. Here's something astonishing, beautiful, Rav Huttner brings down. In a person, when Moshe had to convey his nevuah, in a sense, or his madrega to Yeshua a little bit, so it says, v'nasata mehodcha, it's another understanding of Hod, v'nasata mehodcha, you're going to give from your Hod to Yeshua. Rashi says there, or panim, the light on your face is your Hod. Now, what does this mean? We've spoken about this too in different contexts. The light on a person's face, where does it come from? It comes from inside. It comes from the neshama. The neshama is invisible. The body is visible. But the light in a person's face comes from what? The submission of the will, the desires of the body to the neshama. The submission, the Hod, the being modim, that's why we bow, and we make sure to bow low enough that all 18 vertebrae are, you know, separated from each other, are engaged in that bow. That's why Hashem's name is 18, and Shemona Esrei, 18 brachos, all kinds of 18s. That's the 18 spaces in the back that are supposed to be open, so everyone has to go to Pilates all the time. So that when you, so then you bow down, you're completely submitting your physical powers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When the body submits to the neshama, that creates an or upon him, which is called Hod. Now watch this. The person, the body, the person's physical desire constantly submitting to the neshama, which creates Hod, nasata mehodcha, or upon him, we call that eventually Hadras Panim, Hadar. Hadras Panim. That's Hod Vahadar Lavashta. But you see the Hadras Panim, which is a result of the Hod, the being mode, the modim, the submitting, the acquiescing, that the neshama is paramount. You see that? Is that beautiful, Sir Putner? Beautiful. So here's another example, and this is really essentially the Hanukkah concept. We said, Shtika Koda, Hashem goes quiet, because he's giving Hoda, he agrees with what we're doing. He's letting us now, through this last Kufa, since Hanukkah and onwards, speak on his behalf, as we said, through our survival, through our Torah that comes from us, through the pleasure we get in Torah, which is why we won't give it up, even if they're taking us to a gas chamber, Chas v'Shalom, right? Nebuch. There is pleasure in Torah, and that's why people, astonishing stories that you read, that in the hell of the concentration camps, they distracted themselves with learning, and they got pleasure from it. I just read somewhere, I forgot where, that there was a boy who came to yeshiva after the war. He knew 200 blot Gemara Baal Peh that he learned in Auschwitz with his father somewhere, huddling in a corner. How do you learn unless your mind is settled somehow, unless you get pleasure from it, unless you can attach to it? It's astonishing. So this, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, well, you'll speak for me, but there's more than that. We said there was a transition from prophecy to Chachamim. You know the famous idea, which is so complicated that when we talk about Torah Sheba'al Peh, it's hard to understand it. Torah lo bashamayim hi anymore. Torah is not in the heavens anymore. It doesn't come from God anymore. It doesn't come from the prophet Moshe anymore. It comes from Chachamim. And if Chachamim are debating a halacha and there's a majority vote, and a Navi stands up and says, but I know b'nevuah that the halacha is the other way, what do they say to him? We don't care. It doesn't come from Shemayim. You know the famous story, let the river flow backwards, let the carob tree. We don't care about Nisim. The halacha is established by Chachamim. So you know what that means now? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Modeh, submits to who? to our Torah, our decisions. HaKadosh Baruch Hu submits to our decision, and that becomes the halacha. Hashem is also Moda, the power of the Jewish people. The transition that took place is when Torah becomes ours because we love it, and it gives us pleasure, and it's our life, and we'll die for it. Then HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees our dedication to Torah, how it's completely internalized, how it's become ours, and Hashem is Moda, Modim, to us. That's why the Malachim, when Hashem gave the Torah, they said, Tain Hodcha Bashamayim. You're giving your hod, your submission to the people on earth, to human beings, you're submitting to their interpretation of Torah? And Hashem said, yes, that's the way the Torah is going to exist through the generations. And he showed Moshe Rabbeinu who? Rabbi Akiva, remember that? And when Moshe saw Rabbi Akiva, who was right by the Chorban, by here, expounding on the Torah, he got faint. He got faint. He said, so we'll pray. And he said, what do you need me for? So we know what Hashem needed Moshe for. Moshe was part of the first tkufa, to bring Torah down from heaven. And that was the first phase. But then it becomes internalized, and it comes out of us, as in Rabbi Akiva, who died for it. And how did Rabbi Akiva die? On the word Echad, and he told his Talmidim, who harassed him till the last second, as he was expiring. They said, Rebbe, what are you thinking? Right? That's what a Rebbe has to do. Never stop teaching. And he says, I always wondered if I could serve Hashem b'chol levavcha, with all my heart, and b'chol nafshcha, but with all my soul, if I would ever have that opportunity. And now I have the opportunity to serve Hashem b'chol nafshcha, with my whole soul, which means, Rashi says, even if Hashem takes away your soul, that's how you serve Hashem. And he died with the word echad. Doesn't just mean he was finishing Shema, and he was just happened to be saying echad. He died with the concept of echad. Hashem is one, the chesed, the din, what I understand, what I don't understand. It's all one. I'm dying like Kiddush Hashem. When that's the Torah that comes from inside a person, Hashem is machnia, so to speak. Mod bows to us. And that's how the Torah emerges, through Chachamim. That's Torah Shloba Shemayim Hi. And that's the power, the force of Klal Yisrael, the force of Hod, which becomes Hadar, the beauty, when you look back. So we see Klal Yisrael submitted to the onslaught of the nations, but then our ideas that we will not separate from become the beauty of the world. The person develops a Hadras Panim because of a lifetime of submission to the Neshama. HaKadosh Baruch Hu submits the Klal Yisrael, and Torah is ours. It's our Torah. By the way, it's called Torah's Moshe. Even back then, Hashem didn't call it my Torah. He called it Torah's Moshe, as if Moshe created it. He gives it over to us. That's what David HaMelech is saying as we started in the first Tehillim. With Torah's Hashem Cheftso, Hashem's Torah is his love, his desire. He gets pleasure from it. Ube Torah, so then it becomes him. And once it's his, Yege, Yom, and Belayla, you never stop appreciating and enjoying and dwelling on it, because it comes, it's something we love, we're addicted to. So well, now we say this, the liberation, and this is our main idea, the Geula, it was a war, right? It was a Gula, so there's a Geula. We talk about the Geula to serve Hashem freely. There was a Geula in a way that the Greeks left, you know, they picked up and left Eretz Yisrael. But the deep core Geula is we liberated Torah from being external. We liberated Torah from living in a world that wasn't part of ours, in a sense. We integrated Torah. We liberated Torah from its kind of prison, that it existed by itself in its own dimensions, in its own world, in its own madrega. And we brought it into ourselves and made it part of us. The aura of the sneh, which was a nace in nature, became the aura of the menorah, which is also, as we said, like a branch, like a little branch, you know, type, you know, signifies that type of bush, so to speak, or plant. And that nair, that aura, that fire, now lives inside every single Jew, as we call the pintel yid. It's liberated, in a sense, and it becomes everybody's possession. In fact, the menorah is the only keli in the Beis HaMikdash that we build, not in gold though, to duplicate, not, we don't want to duplicate, and we take it into our own homes, and we use it. In a sense, we liberated the R from the Beis HaMikdash. Now it's in all of our homes. When it was in the Beis HaMikdash, in its miraculous sense, it was part of that dimension of miracles from heaven. But when it came into every Jew's home, it became every Jew's possession. It became every Jew's heritage. We, in a sense, liberated the Torah, or the fire of the Torah, which can consume, you know, all our enemies. We liberated, in a sense, from being only in Hashem's hands to being now our possession, alive in every single Jew. So that's the Geula. And when we light the Hanukkah menorah, Rambam brings down, and if a person is Zahir with lighting Hanukkah menorahs, they're careful. They do it on time. They do it with shemen. They do it with oil. They do it in a beautiful menorah. They are careful with the brachas. It's a zechus that they should, their children should be talmidei chachamim. They should know how to learn Torah and love Torah. Now you see the connection. It says if you're careful with Hanukkah menorahs, you're zocha to talmidei chachamim for children. He also brings down the Gemara. This is how we're going to start end. That the Rambam says in Mishneh Torah and Hilchas Chanukah, the commandment to kindle the Chanukah lights is chaviv, it's the most precious of the mitzvahs. Most chaviv, ahov, beloved, chaviv of the mitzvahs. It is the most precious mitzvah, Rambam says, because it comes from our pleasure, from our love, our appreciation, our sense that we are the source of Torah now. We appreciate that HaKadosh Baruch Hu trusts us, bows to us in a sense, lets us be the source of Torah. We will do whatever it takes to maintain our identity as the source of Torah. That gives us pleasure, even despite the pain. And this light of Hanukkah that burns, this little light in every Jewish home, eventually will explode onto the world once more as the Or Chadash B'Tzion Ta'ir, the great light that will shine in Tzion. That we are preserving through this time in our homes and each year in our menorahs. Okay, everybody, have a wonderful Hanukkah. Okay, stop. Next week on Hanukkah.